Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And it's all about compliance with the Constitution. Now, we're still going through, and if I didn't get a chance to really gander, but we're getting close to that point where the language is going to start significantly changing and the Constitution itself is going to start taking form. Instead of it being laid out in the resolutions and so forth, they'll finally get to a point where they start creating the articles and it's kind of, I guess this is when the style committee starts working on putting things together so it's more logical, better presented, everything's, you know, everything in legislative is in one section or article, and judicial in one article, executive, so forth and so on. So, because at this point, they're still working out, obviously, the representation. They're still working out the admission of new states and the slave issue and so forth. And so as they're pounding and pounding and pounding, trying to get past certain issues, they're still working out other things that we're not even seeing. As a matter of fact, when we really look at the matters of the roles and responsibilities for the president, they haven't even hit that. They haven't even hit jurisdiction for the courts. They really still are working in the general body, the body of the whole. They're still working on everybody agreeing, because as we just read, as actually Sean just read, it was Governor Morris who said, if slavery is going to have full representation, you know, and not this three-fifths rule, then I'm going to rule in favor of making sure that the state legislature appoints and gets their suffrage out of that second branch or out of the Senate. So there's still, the concrete or the cast has not been set. They're still working on these final details to where they get, I think, far enough across the finish line to where there's not just a basic majority, there is a higher consensus for in agreeing with what they're doing. So anyway, where we are right now, folks, is we're on page 184, should be 184 in the document you've downloaded. This is on Saturday, July 14th, and technically, this is right before Monday, July 17th, this is Madison speaking. This is the last time he speaks on the day, if he spoke before. I don't know if he did speak before. No, this is the first time he spoke. And so anyway, and this is really regarding admission of new states and, again, this long-fought-out battle over representation. Property, apportionment taxes, who gets represented, and so forth. So let's go ahead, Tammy, since you're back, and welcome back, Sean and Tammy. Tammy, since you're back, why don't you start us off with this first lead-in? This is a long one, so we'll split this up. And go ahead and stop when you get down to the votes be equal, and then we'll have Sean pick up and carry the rest of the rest of Madison's comments. So go ahead and get this started. Thanks so much.
Okay. Mr. Madison expressed his apprehensions that if the proper foundation of government was destroyed by substituting an equality in place of a proportional representation, no proper superstructure would be raised. If the small states really wish for a government armed with the powers necessary to secure their liberties and to enforce obedience on the larger members as well as on themselves, he could not help thinking them extremely mistaken in their means. He reminded them of the consequences of laying the existing confederation on improper principles. All the principal parties to its compilation joined immediately in mutilating and fettering the government in such a manner that it has disappointed every hope placed on it. He appealed to the doctrine in arguments used by themselves on a former occasion. It had been very properly observed by Mr. Patterson that representation was an expedient by which the meeting of the people themselves was rendered unnecessary, and that the representatives ought therefore to bear a proportion to the votes which their constituents, if convened, would respectively have. Was not this remark as applicable to one branch of the representation as to the other? But it had been said that the government would in its operation be partly federal, partly national, that although in the latter respect the representatives of the people ought to be in proportion to the people, yet in the former it ought to be according to the number of states. If there was any solidity in this distinction, he was ready to abide by it. If there was none, it ought to be abandoned. In all cases where the general government is to act on the people, let the people be represented and the votes be proportional. In all cases where the government is to act on the states as such, in like manner as Congress now acts on them, let the state be represented and the votes be equal.
Okay, so thank you so much. And Sean, if you want to pick it up from that point, with this was the true ground of compromise.
True ground of compromise, if there was any ground at all. But he denied that there was any ground. He called for a single instance in which the general government was not to operate on the people individually. The practicability of making laws with coercive sanctions for the states as political bodies had been exploded on all hands. He observed that the people of the large states would in some way or other secure to themselves a weight proportioned to the importance accruing from their superior numbers. If they could not affect it by a proportional representation in the government, they would probably accede to no government, which did not in great measure depend for its efficacy on their voluntary cooperation, in which case they would indirectly secure their object. The existing Confederacy proved that where the acts of the general government were to be executed by the particular governments, the latter had a weight in proportion to their importance. No one would say that either in Congress or out of Congress, Delaware had equal weight with Pennsylvania. If the latter was to supply 10 times as much money as the former, and no compulsion could be used, it was of 10 times more importance that she should voluntarily furnish the supply. In the Dutch Confederacy, the votes of the provinces were equal, but Holland, which supplies about half the money, governs the whole republic. He enumerated the objections against inequality of votes in the second branch, notwithstanding the proportional representation in the first. 1, the minority could negative the will of the majority of the people. 2, they could extort measures by making them a condition of their assent to other necessary measures. 3, they could obtrude measures on the majority by virtue of the peculiar powers which would be vested in the Senate. 4, the evil, instead of being cured by time, would increase with every new state that should be admitted, as they must all be admitted on the principle of equality. 5, the perpetuity it would give to the preponderance of the Northern against the Southern scale was a serious consideration. It seemed now to be pretty well understood that the real difference of interest lay not between the large and small, but between the North and Southern states. The institution of slavery and its consequences formed the line of discrimination. There are 5 states on the South, 8 on the Northern side of this line. Should a proportional representation take place, it was true the North side would still outnumber the other, but not in the same degree at this time, and every day would tend towards an equilibrium.
Okay, so there's a couple of things I wanted to point out. And first off, when in Tammy's section, what I wanted to do was I wanted to kind of point out that with this one line, Madison kind of laid it out there that, and this is in the towards the center of what Tammy read. It had been very properly observed by Mr. Patterson that representation was expedient by which the meaning of the people themselves was rendered unnecessary, and that the representatives ought therefore to hear or to bear a proportion to the votes which their constituents, if convened, would respectively have. In other words, this is laying out and helping people start to see that when we hire, when we elect a representative, whether it's the representative that's representing the people, or whether the representative in a Republican form of government is representing the states, they are to actually represent their constituents, which means that they're providing a proxy vote for them. In these days, the only way that they could understand what their constituents want is they had to spend a little bit of time with them. And unfortunately, sometimes the little bit of time they got, especially with politicians that were sitting in D.C., would be during the election time. And, oh, well, we want you to do this. We want you to... And so that way, they would be told what they wanted. So this is where we, the people, one, became very problematic because we started asking for things that they didn't have the authority to give us. And so when they actually got away with giving those things to us, then it just got a little bit more and got a little bit more. And the point is that, one, they're supposed to be proxy, but they're also supposed to come back and tell us, I'm sorry, you can't have that. We don't have the authority to grant those things to you. But instead, they looked at it as an opportunity for one, them to succeed and to make something for themselves out of it, which is how the swamp literally got created. But nevertheless, in Sean, in your portion, when they talked about this principle of equality, this is down when you were reading 1, 2, 3, and then 4. And in the fourth one, the evil, instead of being cured by time, because he's talking about having this equality, would increase with every state that would be admitted. And the point that I wanted to make is, because it's not that I necessarily agreed with what he was saying, because actually I disagree. I think that Madison, at this point in his perspective, was still looking at the concept of being more, Congress being more representative of the people, ignoring the representation of the state and understanding the checks and balances, because he was arguing against this, arguing at least against the equality of the states and so forth. But the point that he's bringing in here at the very end of 4 is, as they must all be admitted on the principle of equality. Well, if you're going to give the state suffrage, then there needs to be that principle of equality in representation as well. In other words, this last line kind of countered what he was really trying to say, if that makes sense. So I just wanted to point those two things out that kind of jumped out for me. Now, as we kind of go on and on and on and keep going and through this long process, we actually go quite a bit down, and we're going to find ourselves down on page 194. And this is a point where they start talking about, and they use this term, executive magistrate. And so this is where they talk about the executive and so forth. And it's worth, because I've got it highlighted, it's worth kind of looking into, but the point is that they, at this point in time, they still were referring to somebody in government as the magistrate. And they looked at the magistrate being the all-powerful one. But the end product of the Constitution did not allocate the magistrate to the executive. Nor did it really allocate, because they even used the term magistrate, because, as a matter of fact, I think, Sean, you looked it up before. What is a magistrate? Sean, did you remember looking it up? Maybe not. Maybe you didn't look it up.
Yes, I did.
Okay, so what's a magistrate?
According to the internet, it's used in a variety of systems of government. Is it a judicial or administrative officer who plays a key role in the legal system?
Okay, so actually,
typically handling minor legal matters.
Yeah, so that's the new definition. Actually, look up the British magistrate, because they're evolving out of the British government, and it doesn't capture back then what a magistrate was. Go ahead and look up the British magistrate. What is a magistrate in Britain? Because the magistrate in Britain is the king. And the magistrate has he's basically the judge, jury, lawmaker. I mean, he had all the power. And so he was kind of like the unquestionable, which is one of the reasons why the doctrine of a lesser magistrate came forward. So getting into, because I've covered this before, but I don't cover it every year, and it's probably been a long time since I went into this. When we look at the British evolution of government, they went from the civil law of Rome, and they incorporated that until the 7th, 8th century, somewhere in there, they incorporated the Anglo-Saxon legal system. And they, you know, got along for a couple of centuries, but they didn't like that. And so they instituted, I think in the 11th century, about 100 some years before the new era of the Britain Republic, they created, the legal system was then based on, in the 11th century, of common law. And what the king or the monarch did was he established these justices that would basically work with him in maintaining justice. Him being the king, he was kind of delegating out to them, and in common law, they started creating case law precedents and establishing that. Well, that went sideways when the barons drew swords on the king and said, look, you know, we don't like what you're doing here, because we you're denying us what we believe are rights that we have. So that was when they basically took the king hostage, King John, and worked out the Magna Carta. And in so doing, this is when King John implemented Parliament and created representation for the people. So the magistrate then again shifted away from this second magistrate of the courts back to the king, and then Parliament would be struggling with the king as far as what the law was, what it was to be, because supposedly Parliament was now empowered because they were now a republican form of government. Now, you know, monarchs don't like giving up their power. So eventually, this concept of the land barons and their position as the guardians of the people out throughout these areas of land, what they ended up calling them was counts, and the counts ended up evolving into royalty, so that the king basically said, well, you guys technically are royalty now. This took, you know, time. It evolved to where the king basically, under everybody's noses, started appointing sheriffs, and then the sheriff became that now they knew lesser magistrate instead of the courts. But in Britain, the magistrate, the guy that was the grand poobah, was the king. And he had the final say on most everything. I mean, he was the one that decided whether they were going to go to war with America or not, because he made the choice of not giving us our rights and representation. That was his choice. And so, anyway, so there is, if you really look, and I don't know if you've looked at the difference between the magistrate in Britain, or the magistrate in the British government, in the old magistrate, and today, it's redefined, right?
I'm not finding anything to support what you're saying. It says that the common law definition of a magistrate in Britain during colonial times was often referred to as a justice of the peace.
Uh-huh.
The king was not a magistrate in a legal sense. The king presided over the curia regis. The royal court was the ultimate source of legal authority. He functioned as a sovereign head of state.
Yeah, so I'll,
not
I'll,
as a local judicial officer. Magistrates were subordinate to royal authority and acted under commissions issued by the crown.
Yeah, so actually, because there's another source that actually goes into the magistrate at one point in time was the sovereign. It was actually just a different term because he was the not just making law, but he was the final judge of law. And when you look at...
In mine, it says they referred to the king as the chief magistrate.
Yeah, yeah, the supreme. Just like Moses was the final magistrate of all. When, you know, the judges couldn't solve the problem and it finally got to him, he was the ultimate. And so the king, under that same mechanism, that same system, but see, what they're trying to do is they're trying to conflate it or they're trying to transform it to where when we look today, we look at the judges being our magistrates, when technically, under our Constitution, we don't have magistrates. Judges are confined to hearing cases based on law and fact. Under the Constitution, common law was not implemented. The technicality of bringing in case law and precedents was not allowed. You couldn't just say, oh, well, because they ruled this way, now we can go that way. The powers were very defined for the judiciary, as well as the executive, as well as the legislative. So the whole point that I try to really help everybody see out of why counties matter most is that we took a magistrate form of government where basically most all the power was set at a very high level. And it was recreated under the Articles of Association and Confederation because we had Continental Congress. And technically, Continental Congress was that magistrate. When they decided to actually, you know, hear a case, either they heard the case or they would decide to appoint a judge. If you go through the Articles of Confederation, which we did already, that is basically the Continental Congress was a magistrate form of government. They created the laws, they got rid of the laws, and they were the ones that were both the executive as well as the judiciary. And so in this new system, they took that supreme ruler and they divided the functions of the laws, legislating, taxing, and those powers were granted to the legislative. The enforcement of the law, the execution of the law, was given to the executive, and the hearing of the case in controversies under those things, based on the responsibilities given to the court, that's what their function was. Technically, the Congress had the ability to resolve problems with redress. This goes back to the Magna Carta. Who was the one that ultimately judged and deemed the redress for a petition? The king. That's why in the Magna Carta, when you read that, and I think we read that earlier, didn't we, Sean, this year?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And so in reading that, when the king has failed within 40 days to redress the grievances, then his entire kingdom is given to the person or the group that is seeking redress. In other words, they have anything and everything other than his authority. They can take his possessions, those things, until he finally redresses the problem. In other words, they put teeth in this process of petitioning for the redress of grievances. So anyway, this part right here that we're reading really kind of talks in it. They're using this capital M magistrate, but yet they still haven't pounded out. And I believe this is kind of deceptive, or it creates a level of confusion because the Constitution really changes. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so if you actually search the if you search the notes in the Word document and you look for magistrate, they use the term 64 times. And my point here is, how many times does the Constitution actually mention the magistrate? Has anybody searched the Constitution for the word magistrate?
Zero.
Zero times.
Pretty sure it's not there at all.
That's right. And that's because, and so the reason I took this time to basically tell you, we're going to skip over this, because this is where they're still clinging to some paradigms that are literally going to be drummed out of what they are going to create. But I wanted to point out that the language is there, and the language had, it's like bad ideas. Bad ideas just stick around, and if you let them stick around, they'll, and you let them get some sunlight and spill a little water on them. Next thing you know, they grow legs and they become a pest, or they start bothering you, like a weed, what have you. And what I have found,
right, citizenship.
Well, yes, that as well as the doctrine of lesser magistrates. Technically, the doctrine of lesser magistrate doesn't fly under our Constitution. This concept, and I know Sheriff Mack goes around and, you know, kind of builds up the role of the sheriff. In our Republican form of government, the people we're supposed to be fixated on and working with and seeking redress with are our representatives. The only time you walk into a court, the only time you'd really walk into a court is when there's a controversy between you and somebody else that actually falls under the Constitution. So, 9 times out of 10, this is why Madison stated in the ratification debates, and we will get to this because I'm kind of jumping through a few things here. The point is that it's towards the end of the ratification debates, they kept on complaining about the court and its jurisdiction, and Madison said, look, hold on here. Their jurisdiction is limited. The chances of a private citizen walking into a federal court would be like less than 1%. 99.9% of the time, all of these cases are going to be held, the cases that people deal with are going to be held at the state level. They won't go into federal court because those things don't happen under federal court, as they, those things that they're talking about. It has to be something that arises under the Constitution. And that means that it's very, very limited. Very, it may be militia in form, but it would be, it would have to initiate at the state level, or maybe even at the county level. But anyway, so I wanted to point out, I'm not removing highlights here. So you're going to, you know, so you'll go and, oh, GR's got these. And actually, these aren't noted there. You know, usually there's like a little note that says magistrate or electors. Actually, if you keep going down, you're going to see electors and then electors, because this is where they kind of talk about the choosing of representation by the, because electors has two meanings. Electors in the Constitution has two meanings. One, it's the voters. I always prefer to use the term electorate because the electorate is the voters. There's no question in anybody's mind that's the voters. That's the electorate. The electors are the ones chosen to do a very specific function in the Constitution. It's actually a name and a title, and there's qualifications to it. It's the same qualifications to be an elector in the a federal elector in choosing the president. The qualifications are the same as a representative. So you got to be 25 years of age and a citizen for 7 years or whatever. Anyway, so I'm going to skim over those. And the reason why is because the choosing of the president may be kind of important as far as elections go and so forth. They don't get into the details of the Electoral College in these notes. What they do is in the Constitution, they lay out a very specific process. When we read the Constitution of what and how the Electoral College is to form and how the Electoral College is to act, that is not being done today. And so I could have you read those things and then we can talk about it. But the real problem was that this wasn't really beaten out in the ratification debates because more people were concerned about other things. So if there were two problems or two things that kind of pop up that would have created confusion for people, the magistrate is one of those, and the electors and how the electoral college is to form, the best way to look at it is how it was written in the Constitution, and then the problems that the states ended up having. The electors and the Electoral College actually was covered in the ratification debates, and it was succinctly, and I'll just say not universally, because in every of the debates that it was brought up, the electors were to be chosen by the people. That is not followed today, folks. In other words, when it comes to the presidential election year, you're not to see the president's names on the ballot. You're to see the electors that are running within your district, within your congressional district, that you're going to elect to actually choose that president. And that elector is supposed to actually, the electors that are running for the, you know, for election are the ones that are supposed to be basically standing up and going, if you vote for me, I'll vote for this person because he stands for this. The reason they did this is because they couldn't fathom running a real political campaign across America in the days that they lived. They didn't have jets. They didn't have Zoom. They didn't have the ability to really effectively run a campaign. So the campaign was to be done by the electors for them. This is why Madison in 1800, when not Madison in 1800, it was Madison in 1808, didn't spend a penny on his election campaign, not a cent. All he did was he wrote correspondence out to the electors that Jefferson had and said, basically, ditto, I am running, my platform's the same, let's keep going. And that was it. And the electors went out and ran the campaigns, and they got elected, and they elected Madison hands down. Wow. I mean, you imagine how smooth and how easy presidential elections could be when you really think about it. But the point is that they're highlighted. You can skim through those, but they really don't get into the details in the notes that we would like to see. That when you get into the ratification debate, especially on the Electoral College and who chooses the electors and the choosing of the president, we, the people, are to choose the electors, and that's how it came out. Anyway, before moving forward, because it's necessary, because they threw it out there, when the Constitution was formed and the states started actually creating the Electoral College, guess what happened? Every one of the states decided to go down their own path and come up with their own way of interpreting that. That would have been a case where somebody could have easily said, hey, they're not following the Constitution. All of the states probably would have been dragged into court because they were all making up the, you know, I don't think if it's in why counties matter most, if you go to the index, or not the index, the appendixes, the appendix actually shows how the states were functioning or basically selecting their electors. And I think maybe only one or two states in the very first election was getting it right. They didn't get it right consistently until 1832. And there was only one state that never got it right, and that was South Carolina. South Carolina state legislature was the ones that always appointed the electors. They weren't to appoint the electors. As a matter of fact, when you read the clause, that the state legislature is to choose the time, place, and manner for choosing, for running the election of choosing the president. Time, place, and manner, not outcome. Not determining who they are. They were to determine the time, place, and manner. And so, but they said, oh, we're going to do it. And that's what they did. And nobody challenged them on it. But anyway, so we're skipping over a lot. And we're jumping down to where Mason goes into, and so we start talking about property again. And so you'll actually notice that kind of above that, there's this yellow talking about magistrates and so forth. We're going to be focused on the blue, and this is on page, drum roll please, everybody's been waiting for it, 241. And on page 241, this is July 26th, and the little subtext is property. So you can kind of see that in the navigation pane if you're using that. And if you actually count down, Colonel Mason is the first speaker, then Davy, then Franklin actually speaks. And let me see here. Now, this was not about the prayer. So this is one of the very few times Franklin spoke. But then Morris spoke, and then Mason again of Virginia spoke, and he starts speaking on property. This brings us right back to this long age, this whole, you know, knuckle brawl that they've been having on trying to figure out representation, apportionment, admission of states. It all was centered around this. So let's go ahead. Tammy, are you there? Do you know where we're at?
We're on 241, Colonel Mason.
Yep, 241, property. Yeah, Colonel Mason moved that the committee go ahead and take it up from there. Thank you so much.
Yeah, Mr. Mason moved that the committee of details be instructed to receive a clause requiring certain qualifications of landed property and citizenship of the United States and members of the legislature, and disqualifying persons having unsettled accounts with or being indebted to the U.S. from being members of the national legislature. He observed that persons of the latter descriptions had frequently got into the state legislatures in order to promote laws that might shelter their delinquencies, and that this evil had crept into Congress if report was to be regarded.
Okay, so how important was that little point or this assertion that he made? Sean, Tammy?
I'd say it's very important considering the state that we're in now.
Yeah.
How many times did we have people go into, do you remember, we've had presidents become presidents when they've actually owed back taxes, and we actually had the treasurer under Obama that was in hot water. Just think, yeah. Had this actually been clarified as a qualifier for the president and all people of elected and being appointed, that they could not serve, you know, under oath at all if they had these delinquencies. Wow. Mason was a brilliant man. The only thing I pick on him about is he was so fixated on his Bill of Rights that I think he was just really looking more for, you know, living, you're creating a true legacy for him. Like Thomas Jefferson, his legacy was done. The Declaration of Independence. That man, everybody knows that man because of that. And nobody knows the association of the work that Mason did regarding the Bill of Rights in Virginia. I mean, it was a great piece of work. And his underling at the time that did it was James Madison. And Madison, if just a little backstory here, but Madison really kind of bit his tongue. He was very, during the convention, these types of things, when they kind of, if, when and if they came up, I'm sure he just bit his tongue. In the debates, he clearly laid it out that we didn't need a Bill of Rights because the Constitution enumerated powers, and if those powers weren't delegated, they can't meddle with it. So why do we need a Bill of Rights? Because they're very limited to only these things. You hear me say this all the time, folks. If we held them accountable to the things that they can do and make sure that they don't do those things that they're not supposed to do, then all of our problems start going away, because that's all about constitutional compliance. But Mason was just harping and haranguing and just on and on about the Bill of Rights. And so it was ironic, and or probably, I don't know, you come up with your own word, but after the Constitutional Convention, or the debates, I should say, and the Constitution was ratified, Madison then shifted and said, I am now going to run it. And I think it was out of respect for Mason, but back in those days, they really didn't do it for a legacy to actually come out. You know, Thomas Jefferson didn't go, hey, you know, I'm going to write the Declaration of Independence and be a star. You know, the being a star was, you know, just the byproduct of the good work that he did. And I think it was the same thing with Mason. And so I think Madison just kind of took what Mason was doing, saw the importance of it, and drove that into into the legislative house for the very first session, got the Bill of Rights started, and got them into the Constitution. And we've never looked back, because that's the only thing people were fixated on. Everybody's, oh, they're stepping on my rights. No, 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 no. It's even worse than that. They're doing things they have no authority to do. They're spending your money. Who cares, you know, about some of these other things when you look at the magnitude of stuff that they're doing? Like teaching your kids crap. You know, like creating energy policies that are selling us downriver to the globalists. On and on and on. I mean, not that the Bill of Rights aren't important, but they pale in comparison to the unconstitutional actions, roles, responsibilities, properties, on and on, that they are assuming. So anyway, okay, so Mason stated this, and I think, again, this was very prophetic, that this needed to be embedded, it needed to be ingrained, it needed to be galvanized as a part of a standing that, you know, you can't go into office at all if you owe taxes or these things. So anyway, so Mr. Pinckney seconded the motion. Now Governor Morris then speaks up regarding the qualifications, and go ahead, Sean, go ahead and share that with us.
If qualifications are proper, he would prefer them in the electors rather than the elected. As to debtors of the U.S., they are but few. As to persons having unsettled accounts, he believed them to be pretty many. He thought, however, that such a discrimination would be both odious and useless, and in many instances, unjust and cruel. The delay of settlement had been more the fault of the public than of the individuals. What will be done with those patriotic citizens who have lent money or services or property to their country without having been yet able to obtain a liquidation of their claims? Are they to be excluded? And that brought me to a question. Is he talking about personal debt, or is he talking about the state's debt? And they were in the Congress of the state, and then they go up to the federal government. Are they disqualified because their state owes money?
Yeah, so at the state level, because at this point in time, the federal government doesn't have anything, right? They don't exist. This Constitution hasn't been created. So currently, the way Continental Congress and the Articles of Confederation, they just send out an allocation that we need you to give us this money. And they base it on what the property citizenry that they agreed upon. And that was handed to the state legislature, and then they had to tax the people. Now, when we look at the different taxes, one of the taxes that they had was a property tax. It was called, basically, it functioned as the poll tax. And it helped pay for the elections and government itself. And so that tax was out there. But there was always a tax on your productivity. In other words, however much you sold, there was a revenue. It was like an income tax, but it was based on what you brought to market. You could have actually increased, and you could have made, increases in your business, but not garnered any species for it. And what I mean by that is you can easily, turn a whole crop into seed so that now you have really good seed for the next year. Because if you don't need to have profit because you're kind of sitting fat and pretty and, everything's good for you right now, then why pay taxes for that year, and just grow a crop for seed, what have you, so that the next year you can, okay, now we'll make money again and I'll pay taxes on it, but I'm in a better position now because I've invested this back in me. Anyway, so they did have taxes. And so there were taxes and debt. And there were creditors and banks and so forth. So they had it all at the state and local level. Let me ask you this. What Supreme Court justice went to jail, went to debtor's prison because of his debt? Had they actually instituted this policy, this standard, then he would never have been appointed a Supreme Court justice. Anybody looking it up? Because there was one Supreme Court justice that ended up going to debtor's prison because he couldn't pay his debt. Anyway, so
who was it?
I don't know off the top of my head. I'm bad with names, but I could look it up. And anyway, so Mr. Gorham of Massachusetts was for leaving the legislature and providing, against such abuses on their own. Let them kind of regulate the behavior, these standards. I believe that the standards needed to be ingrained. They needed to be out there so that people could see that our government was, the people in our government, were not beholden to anybody and were not corruptible. Because it's easy to see people that are in debt, people that, can't pay their bills and so forth, they're pretty easy to corrupt. Okay, so now Colonel Mason then opines again. And so I think, Tammy, this one's yours. Go ahead. Short.
Okay. Colonel Mason mentioned the parliamentary qualifications adopted in the reign of Queen Anne, which he said had met with universal approbation.
Okay. All right. So we could do that, but again, if you don't put the language in there, then it can easily get washed away. How important was this? I think this was huge. Okay, so Sean, go ahead and read Madison's response.
Madison, Virginia. He had witnessed the zeal of men having accounts with the public to get into the legislatures for sinister purposes. He thought, however, that if any precaution were to be taken for excluding them, the one proposed by Colonel Mason ought to be new modeled. It might be well to limit the exclusion to persons who had received money from the public and had not accounted for it.
Which is something completely different as well. There you go. So people that are taking money from the public and don't account for it. So Governor Morris then pipes in, and go ahead, Tammy.
Mr. Governor Morris, it was a precept of great antiquity as well as high authority that we should not be righteous over much. He thought we ought to be equally on our guard against being wiser over much. The proposed regulation would enable the government to exclude particular persons from offices as long as they pleased. He mentioned the case of the commander-in-chief presenting his account for secret services, which he said was so moderate that everyone was astonished at it, and so simple that no doubt could arise on it. Yet, had the auditor been disposed to delay the settlement, how easily might be have affected it, and how cruel would it be in such case to keep a distinguished and meritorious citizen under a temporary disability and disenfranchisement. He mentioned this case merely to illustrate the objectionable nature of the proposition. He was opposed to such minutious regulations in a constitution. The parliamentary qualifications quoted by Colonel Mason had been disregarded in practice and was but a scheme of the landed against the moneyed interest.
Yay. Okay, so Sean looked it up, and as a matter of fact, I forgot that that gentleman is actually in this forum, and that gentleman was key in, you know, the ratification debates of Pennsylvania. And that gentleman that went to debtor's prison from the Supreme Court seat that he was sitting in, occupied at the time, was James Wilson. So back in those days, they took that stuff seriously. And it's interesting how, you know, you hear these people, they speak righteously and what have you, but, you know, we've all got our own problems, right? Okay, so anyhow, a little trivia finally resolved. Mr. Pinckney and General Pinckney both moved to insert, by way of amendment, the words judiciary and executive so as to extend the qualifications to those departments, which was agreed to without contest. And then Mr. Gary of Massachusetts thought the inconvenience of excluding a few worthy individuals who might be public debtors or have unsettled accounts ought not to be put in the scale against the public advantages of the regulation, and that the motion did not go far enough. Interesting. So they wanted made more restrictions. In other words, these men really wanted to have the best of the best. Right? Seemed like it. Anyway, we've got about 1 minute left, and then we've got King, who makes this. Let me just go through that. King observed, of Massachusetts, Rufus King, observed that there might be great danger in requiring landed property as a qualification, since it would exclude the moneyed interest whose aids may be essential in particular emergencies to the public safety and so forth. And what, were they going to reach in their pocket and pay public debt? I have no idea what that thought was, but I do know the revolution was paid for by out of some people's pockets and so forth. Anyway, any go backs to talk about what we kind of covered, because we've got more and we don't have time. We'll have to pick this up in the next show. Tammy, Sean?
Nope.
No, sir.
Okay, so with the residual time, let me get my cane and hat, and I will just do a short little tap with a rendition to Spring. What is it? Moon River. We'll do Moon River. Anyway, I'm just kidding. As we move forward, what we're trying to do is we're trying to focus on the land, the property, the representation, admission of states, and equally the importance of state legislative proxy or representation in the USN. These are all key things that we need to be focused on because we're seeing the problems today. I'm G.R. Mobley with Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.